and welcome to another episode of Scrubcast. I'm Eamon Amo. With me today is Mr. Sanjay Pandana Boyana, one of our consultant HPV surgeons here at the Freeman Hospital. Sanjay, welcome to Scrubcast.
Thank you, Eamon.
So Mr. Pandana Boyana's specialist interest is acute and chronic pancreatitis and pancreatic cancer, which fits in nicely with today's talk. Today we're going to be talking about pancreatic adenocarcinoma. Sanjay, that's a real problem in the Western world, it's fair to say, isn't it?
Yeah, it is indeed, Eamon, especially in the UK. You get about 10,000 new cancers diagnosed every year, pancreatic cancers, and it's the third most common cancer within the UK, and the fourth or fifth common cause of cancer-related death within the UK. So yeah, it is a big problem in the UK. And unfortunately, as you probably know, the majority of them present with metastatic disease or inoperable disease by the time they get to the HPV MDT or see an HPV surgeon, with only about 10-15% of patients having resectable disease. So it does have a huge psychological impact and survival impact on the patient, so it is a big problem.
That is quite a low rate for resectable disease on presentation. Sanjay, we know that the majority of these tumours are ductal adenocarcinomas, or PDACs. But what do we know about the precursor lesions for these tumours?
In terms of the precursors for pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma, pancreatic intraepithelial neoplasia is considered as a precursor. But you have to remember that that's a histological diagnosis.
So it's not a pan-in.
So it is a histological diagnosis. It's not something you could see clinically or see in a CT scan. But what we tend to see in a clinical scenario more often is, in terms of the risk factors, the precursors are IPMNs, which are fairly common, intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasms, especially these days when we're doing MRIs and CT scans quite often and quite frequently for patients. And often IPMNs are incidentally picked based on CT scans. So these are considered as precursors for pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. Another cystic lesion we commonly tend to see is the mucinous cystic neoplasms, which are again precursors. And not to forget chronic pancreatitis, which is quite common in this part of the world because of alcohol excess and for other reasons. Chronic pancreatitis is considered as a very important precursor for pancreatic cancer. Patients with chronic pancreatitis have 4 to 8-fold increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer as compared to general population.
So you mentioned IPMN and mucinous cystic neoplasms. For the general surgeon out there, it isn't uncommon that they find an incidental pancreatic cyst, for example. We get a lot of referrals at the Freeman Hospital for pancreatic cystic lesions. So when you look at these at the specialist HPV MDT meeting, what do you look at that makes you differentiate between simple cysts and cysts that you worry about? What are the worrisome features?
Yeah, that's a good question because when we do see a cystic lesion and a CT scan at the MDT, often we do not have a scan to compare it with because this is just a one CT scan. And we don't know what's the growth of this cystic lesion, whether it's been growing over the last few years or is it been quite static. There are quite a few variables which will determine whether this cystic lesion is high risk or worrisome for developing pancreatic cancer. And in the European consensus guidelines were published 2 years ago, which are quite robust, and that's what we tend to follow here, which determines these cysts are high risk or worrisome. So the worrisome features tend to be a slightly dilated main pancreatic duct, up to 5 to 10 millimeters, presence of nodules within that cystic lesion, often non-enhancing. And any cyst more than 4 centimeters is considered as a worrisome. And any patients who develop pancreatitis on a background of a cystic lesion, and if there is any abrupt change in the pancreatic duct caliber, all these are termed as worrisome features. But then there are high-risk features as well, which further increase the risk of developing pancreatic cancer, which would include jaundice. If the patient with a cystic lesion presents with obstructive jaundice, that's quite a high-risk feature. Or the presence of enhancing nodules or the pancreatic duct more than 10 millimeters. Often when you tend to see these high-risk features, we tend to offer them surgery relatively quickly because the risk of malignancy in the presence of high-risk features is much higher.
It's interesting to know that there is a difference in the characteristics of the underlying nodule. So if it's non-enhancing, that's a worrisome lesion. But if it's enhancing, that is high risk there.
It is high risk. And often there is evidence of high-grade dysplasia, even presence of malignancy if it's an enhancing nodule. And that's the reason why these patients tend to get offered a pancreatic resection relatively quickly if they have an enhancing nodule.
Okay. And in terms of the location of these cysts, does that matter at all?
No, it does. I mean, what's important is to know whether this is a side branch IPMN or the main duct IPMN. Side branch IPMNs, the risk of malignancy is much lower than a main duct IPMN. In a side branch, it would be around 30 to 40%. But once you get a main duct IPMN, the risk of malignancy is 60 to 70%. So if you have a dilated pancreatic duct and you're worried about a main duct IPMN, often these patients get a total pancreatectomy relatively quickly. And sometimes you can get mixed type IPMNs, which are a combination of side branch IPMNs and main duct IPMNs. And the risk of malignancy, again, in these will be determined by the main duct IPMN. So, yeah, often we tend to see the side branch IPMNs in the MDT much more common than the main duct IPMNs.
It's interesting that you say that the risk of malignancy is about 30% in the side branch IPMN. So it's not insignificant either. So I presume you offer these patients some sort of surveillance.
Yes. Depends on the age. I think that's something to take into consideration. If you have a 70 or 80-year-old patient with multiple comorbidities, have a cystic lesion which measures about 3 centimeters to 3.5 centimeters, if they're never going to come to surgery because of their comorbidities, we tend to have a discussion with the patient and the family and say the risk of malignancy is low at this stage. It's highly likely these patients would die of natural causes from other diseases rather than the IPMN, so we don't tend to do surveillance for them. But if it's a younger patient, then definitely they need to be under surveillance lifelong, I'm afraid. Even if they have a segmental resection of the pancreas, for instance, if there is an IPMN in the tail of the pancreas and we do a distal pancreatectomy, the rest of the pancreas still needs to be under surveillance for the rest of their lifetime.
Okay, so that's IPMN lesions. What about mucinous cystic neoplasms?
Mucinous cystic neoplasms, as we discussed earlier, are again precursors for pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. Again, we tend to resect these based on the European consensus guidelines. Size criteria, any mucinous cystic neoplasm more than 4 centimeters, we tend to offer resection, or the presence of enhancing nodules, we tend to offer them resection. The thing to remember is sometimes you can get serous cystic neoplasms within the pancreas. Often on an MRI scan, it's relatively easy to differentiate between a serous and a mucinous cystic neoplasm. Mucinous cystic neoplasms tend to be often unilocular. On the other hand, serous cystic neoplasms tend to have a honeycomb appearance, tend to be multicystic. Serous cystic neoplasms are completely benign. They do not warrant resection or even surveillance. On the other hand, mucinous cystic neoplasms do warrant resection. Therefore, it's important we differentiate them both. And if it's not possible to differentiate them on a CT scan or MRI scan, we tend to do an EUS to get fluid from the mucinous cystic neoplasms. Because in mucinous cystic neoplasms, the fluid CEA levels tend to be relatively high. Any CEA level more than 180 is considered to be a risk factor for developing malignancy. And that often differentiates a mucinous cystic neoplasm, which is higher risk versus a low risk.
Okay. So, population-based screening for pancreatic cancer is not something that is provided because of the low lifetime risk, which I think is about 1%. But are there any particular groups that are considered high risk that should be offered surveillance for pancreatic adenocarcinoma?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that population-based screening is not recommended because of low risk of lifetime risk of developing pancreatic cancer. And also, you have to remember, there is no good population screening tool to keep pancreas under surveillance, unlike breast cancer or aneurysms, where it's relatively easy to keep them under surveillance with an ultrasound scan or a mammogram. And that's not the case with pancreas, because you need to subject a patient to a CT scan or an MRI or even a EUS to keep them under surveillance. So it's not very cost-effective given the low lifetime risk of developing pancreatic cancer. But there are certain patient groups who are at high risk of developing pancreatic cancer, which should probably be kept under surveillance. For instance, patients with chronic pancreatitis, definitely under surveillance, as we discussed before, because of risk of pancreatic cancer. Patients with certain genetic syndromes, patients with Fugere syndrome, Lynch syndrome, and patients who have history of BRCA1, BRCA2 mutations. and also patients with familial pancreatitis, especially with PRSS1 and SPINK1 mutations. So these are the groups of patients who should be kept under surveillance at this point of time, and that's what NICE recommends as well. In addition to these groups of patients, we also tend to offer surveillance with patients with family history of pancreatic cancer, especially when they have one or more first-degree relative diagnosed with pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma.
So in these groups, what kind of surveillance tool would you offer?
Because these people need to be on lifelong surveillance again, undertaking CT scans is not a good idea because of risk of radiation exposure. So often these people tend to be in the surveillance with either an MRI or an EUS to reduce the risk of radiation exposure. And yearly MRIs or EUS is what we tend to use.
Okay, for those trainees who are preparing for their FRCS exams, most surgical trainees know that, you know, the presentation here is usually late. And as you mentioned earlier, in many cases, they present with unresectable disease. But are there specific classic signs, symptoms to look out for, and particular radiological findings that you would associate with pancreatic cancer?
Yeah, as I say, most of them have late presentation, with about 80% of them presenting with unresectable disease, either because of local advanced disease or metastatic disease to the liver or lungs. And quite a few of them do present with non-specific symptoms to the GP, especially if they present with new-onset diabetes. That is a red flag. Any patient in their 60s or 70s presenting with new-onset diabetes should be investigated thoroughly to exclude an underlying pancreatic lesion. And as you probably know, painless jaundice is something, again, to worry about. Often painful jaundice is secondary to cholecystitis. But if you have a painless progressive jaundice, again, it's a worrisome sign of underlying pancreatic cancer. And patients, any patient with non-specific central abdominal pain on a background history of weight loss or appetite should generally undergo an ultrasound scan at least to start with to rule out an underlying pancreatic lesion. Often these patients tend to have a CT scan, and the typical features we tend to see on the CT scan, if they're not jaundiced, is a mass in the head of the pancreas or in the body and tail of the pancreas. Pancreatic head cancers generally tend to present with obstructive jaundice, but the ones in the body and tail of the pancreas, because they do not present with obstructive jaundice, often tend to present late. Patients with body and tail of the pancreas tumors often tend to have more aggressive tumors and with liver metastasis by the time they get to presentation. But the head of the pancreas tumors present with the classical double duct sign, where the pancreatic duct is dilated and the bile duct is dilated with the presence of obstructive jaundice.
And in terms of how these tumors enhance with contrast, are there any specific contrast characteristics on a CT? You know, like, for example, for a HCC, you know, there's this sort of classic washout.
The general consensus is all these patients should get a triple phase CT scan, and non-contrast phase, and arterial phase, and the portal venous phase. And the reason for that is we're just not looking at the presence of tumor, but also the relation of the tumor to the portal vein and the supramesenteric artery. So that's very important. These patients get a triple phase CT up front. In terms of contrast findings, often they're enhanced in the portal venous phase, these tumors. Except if it's a new pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, they tend to enhance more in the arterial phase. But it is generally a good practice to have a triple phase CT for all these patients. Any patient who presents with obstructive jaundice to A&E, or if you're surgical trainee, you see them in the surgical assessment suite, it is a good idea to do a triple phase CT scan up front, because the cause of jaundice may not be a pancreatic tumor, it could be a liver tumor, it could be anything, but triple phase CT scan will help in differential diagnosis of these tumors.
Okay, I'm going to have a brave go at one of the classic laws in general surgery, Courvoisier's law, and I'm hoping that I get it right. So it states that in the presence of jaundice, a palpable gallbladder is less likely to be due to gallstones.
That's correct. Yes, that is correct. It's something you see in textbooks, but it's in practice and in reality, it's not something you see very often. I think the idea is, if you have a pancreatic tumor, it will block the bile duct, and then it distends the gallbladder, because the cystic duct the bile obviously is going to backfill and go into the cystic duct and distance the gallbladder.
Mm.
So in the presence of pancreatic cancer, which is painless jaundice, the gallbladder is going to be distended. And that's the idea behind the Kreuzer. Like, this is probably the case 50, 60 years ago when we didn't have radiological investigations. But now that we have these, often patients do not get to that stage.
So it's not old but gold, it's just old. It's still a favorite, though, for
it
examiners.
It is, yeah. Examiners, absolutely. Yeah.
These are ways of diagnosis using... ultrasound obviously isn't a good diagnostic method, but as you say, CT, MR, and EUS.
Yes, MRI is useful not routinely, but if you do a CT scan and if there is a lesion in the liver on the CT scan which you're not sure of whether it's metastasis or not, MRI is quite useful in those scenarios to exclude liver metastasis. And EUS, again, we often do not tend to use it for diagnosis in the first instance. Suspicion of diagnosis of pancreatic cancer is often made on the CT scan. EUS is more to get tissue biopsy. And at this point of time, the sensitivity of EUS in terms of differentiating resectable, borderline resectable, and local advanced tumors is still not very high.
Okay.
So we do not tend to use to differentiate those sort of tumors, but we still do EUS for getting biopsy from the tumors to confirm cancer, especially if they're having neoadjuvant chemotherapy first for borderline resectable or local advanced pancreatic cancer. So that's where EUS comes in.
And is its sensitivity any different to CT in terms of smaller tumors?
The smaller tumors where there is diagnostic where you cannot get a diagnosis and a CT scan, it's still useful to do an EUS more from getting a biopsy perspective. That's the advantage of doing EUS, where you can get a biopsy from the tissue.
Okay. And what about laparoscopy, diagnostic staging? Laparoscopy.
About 10-15 years ago, staging laparoscopy was relatively common for pancreatic cancer, especially if you do not see any peritoneal disease. People still used to get staging laparoscopy. I remember when I was a trainee, we still used to do this routinely. But there's enough evidence to suggest the pickup rate is very low. Only less than 5% of patients at this point of time with resectable disease tend to have metastatic disease, because the radiological investigations these days are so advanced, especially with CT scans and PET CT scans. If there is any peritoneal disease, we often tend to pick that up relatively early before a staging laparoscopy. So that's not current practice. The areas where we do tend to do staging laparoscopy is if there is any suspicious disease on a PET scan or a CT scan. So, for instance, suspicious peritoneal disease or suspicious liver nodule, which you cannot characterize on an MRI, it would still be reasonable to undertake staging laparoscopy on a selective basis, but not on a routine basis.
Yeah, so in this case, so we're talking about not obtaining a diagnosis, but staging the disease, seeing if it is outside the pancreas. But isn't there an argument that you're going to perform some form of surgery anyway, even if you find peritoneal disease? You are going to have to do some form of palliative bypass. Now, is that necessarily the case?
Not necessarily. For instance, if you have a patient who has pancreatic cancer, who had an ERCP and stenting for his jaundice, and by the time he comes to surgery, he's not jaundiced, he doesn't have any gastric outlet obstruction from the tumor, and if you see a peritoneal disease, I do not see any point in opening that patient to do a palliative bypass. But there is a small fraction of patients where you do a laparotomy without doing a staging laparoscopy. You've done quite a bit of dissection, and then you see something suspicious either in the liver or in the retroperitoneum. By that point, you have done a reasonable amount of dissection in the porta hepatis, and you're waiting for the frozen sections to come back. Then it would be reasonable to do a palliative bypass, because then if they do get chemotherapy after surgery, the risk of blocking of stents and further progression of tumor may be relatively high while they're on chemotherapy. And by doing a double bypass, you could probably avoid those scenarios in the future. But when you're doing a laparoscopy and you see peritoneal disease and the patient is not clinically jaundiced or obstructed, then there is no indication to open that patient up and do a palliative bypass.
Okay, well, while we're on the topic of palliative procedures, and you've made it clear that the preference when there's biliary obstruction is to stent the patient rather than do a biliary bypass, but what about gastric outlet obstruction? When would you consider a gastrojejunostomy, and when would you consider stenting? duodenal stenting?
It depends on the stage of the disease. For instance, if you have a patient you are potentially considering for downstaging chemotherapy with a view to operating in the future, a duodenal stenting in those sort of patients might not be the best option. A palliative bypass, a laparoscopic gastrojejunostomy might give them more durable gastroenteric bypass while they're having the chemotherapy. On the other hand, if you have a patient with metastatic disease, with liver metastasis or peritoneal disease, whose survival is quite short, then in those sort of patients, it would be reasonable to do a duodenal stent and a biliary stent rather than put them through a palliative bypass.
Okay. I'm going to take a step back to the radiological findings that you were talking about earlier. We know that there are patients that are described as having resectable disease, patients that are described as having borderline resectable disease, and patients who have locally advanced disease. How do you differentiate radiologically between the three groups?
There are several classifications differentiating resectable, borderline resectable, and locally advanced. Generally, resectable disease is there is no radiological evidence of SMA or portal vein distortion and with clear fat planes around SMA and common hepatic artery. And borderline resectable disease tends to be a bit more advanced with distortion of the portal vein or contact of the SMA or common hepatic artery. And more locally advanced tend to be unreconstructable portal vein or SMV with encasement of SMA or celiac access. But there are 4 to 5 different classifications. But essentially, the gist of all these classifications is the amount of abutment of the SMA and SMV. But the important thing to remember is the distinction between resectable disease and local advanced disease is relatively pretty clear in the literature. But the borderline resectable disease is where the difficulty comes. Mm-hmm. Patients with borderline resectable disease, we don't have enough evidence at this point of time to routinely put them through chemotherapy. Local advanced patients do tend to have chemotherapy to downstage them. With borderline resectable disease, often these patients tend to go through surgery in some centers and have chemotherapy in other centers. So that's where the contentious issue is at the moment. But in terms of the exam for an FRCS point of view, the more pragmatic way of defining these tumors is the IAP classification, the International Association of Pancreatologists classification, where resectability, borderline resectability, or local advanced disease is not purely based on anatomical reasons. It's based on the ABC classification, where it's based on anatomy of the tumor, the biology of the tumor, and the condition of the patient. Because you may have a patient who is anatomically resectable, but poor performance status, it is still considered as borderline resectable for those patients. So any patients who have anatomically resectable tumor is based on anatomy of the tumor in relation to SMA or SME. The biology of the tumor is based on the C199 level. Anybody more than a C199 of more than 500 is tend to be borderline resectable. And the condition is based on performance status. This more applies to the borderline resectable tumors, this ABC classification, but that's more a pragmatic way of dealing with these patients.
Sure. And again, just to simplify the radiological definitions here for FRCS candidates, the difference between abutment and encasement, you use these two terms, the difference is the degree of vessel involvement, I presume. So anything that's less than 50% circumference involvement, is that class as abutment, whereas more than that, encasement, is that what would you...
Yeah, generally, that's what it's concerned. In encasement, often you see tumor around the blood vessel, completely encasing it, and abutment is only part of the circumference of the vessel.
Okay, so we've talked about the definition of locally advanced, borderline resectable, and resectable tumors. But what are the treatment options for each of these?
The treatment options for a resectable disease are pretty standard and straightforward. And if they have resectable disease, then you should consider resection because there is no involvement of the vessels. Locally advanced is maybe 10, 15 years ago when you have a local advanced tumor with SMB or SMA involvement, these patients were considered inoperable. But that is changing now. Now that we have good forms of chemotherapy, especially with the presence of FOLFIRINOX, we see reasonably good response rates to FOLFIRINOX and a small fraction of these local advanced patients, up to 15 to 20, even 30% of patients do eventually come to surgery. So it is, the local advanced patients are not considered inoperable anymore. They are considered potentially resectable these days. Every patient with pancreatic cancer, as long as they don't have peritoneal disease, a liver metastasis, a lung metastasis, should be considered potentially resectable and offer them chemotherapy. I mean, that's what we tend to do now with pancreatic cancers. And that's the change in the view and perception of these tumors in the last 4 or 5 years since the advent of FOLFIRINOX-based chemotherapy or gemcitabine-paclitaxel chemotherapy.
Okay, and so is that standard practice here at the Freeman Hospital that we offer everyone with advanced disease chemotherapy? We don't call it neoadjuvant.
If the patient has a local advanced pancreatic cancer, we tend to give them chemotherapy. At this point of time, we call it as palliative chemotherapy, but potentially resectable palliative chemotherapy. And they get sent back to their referring centers to have the chemotherapy. And at the halfway through chemotherapy or end of chemotherapy, they do get sent back to us to look at the CT scan to see if they have resectable disease. If they do not have resectable disease because of ongoing progression during chemotherapy or they develop disease elsewhere, surgery may not be an option, but we can still offer them radiotherapy if they have still got localized disease which is not resectable. And the other thing we tend to offer now in at the Freeman Hospital is irreversible electroporation for these tumors. If they have reasonably good control of the local disease and they're not resectable, we can offer them IRE, which you may have heard in the last 2-3 years. There is increasing interest in use of IRE for local advanced tumors.
And what about borderline resectable tumors?
Borderline resectable tumors is an area of controversy at this stage because the evidence is not quite there whether we should give them chemotherapy first or not. The NICE guidance is we should resect these patients. So it depends. The borderline resectable, is it borderline resectable venous involvement or borderline resectable arterial involvement? With borderline resectable venous involvement, it's much easier to go ahead with the resection because you can resect the portal vein with a view to achieving an R0 resection. But when you have a borderline resectable arterial involvement with abutment of the vessels, it's highly likely it will result with an R1 resection. So our practice at the Freeman Hospital now is if you have a borderline resectable arterial involvement, we tend to give them chemotherapy again to increase the likelihood of an R0 resection in the future.
Okay. And as you mentioned earlier, many of these patients do present with jaundice. So another area of contention here is what you do when you have a patient with a resectable tumor who presents with jaundice. Do you fast track them for surgery or do you drain the biliary obstruction first?
There's a lot of interest over the last couple of years in terms of fast track Whipple. It depends on the patient. You know, if you have a patient who is pretty fit and healthy with obstructive jaundice with no major comorbidities, then yes, you could consider fast-track Whipple, provided all the staging investigations are done. On the other hand, if you have a patient who has got medical comorbidities, for instance, has mild renal impairment, or somebody who's probably undernourished because of jaundice over the last 3 to 4 weeks, then the risk of perioperative complications is much higher in these groups of patients. So fast-track surgery may not be the right thing for them. They might still be better off having a preoperative biliary drainage to bring the jaundice down and then consider resection at a later stage. But there are a small group of patients who are relatively fit and healthy with obstructive jaundice who could be considered fast-track Whipple with relatively low postoperative morbidity. What we do not know at this point of time is, does this make any difference in terms of long-term survival? Doing a fast-track Whipple, does it have an impact on long-term survival? We do not know at this stage. But from what we can see at the Freeman Hospital and from other centers, for instance, from Birmingham, yes, fast-track Whipple is feasible if the patient is relatively fit and you can do a Whipple with low morbidity with obstructive jaundice.
And I presume that as more evidence is gathered on neoadjuvant therapy, the role of fast-track surgery versus biliary drainage will evolve with time.
Absolutely, yeah. If there is enough evidence over the next few years that even patients with resectable disease, there are some trials going on even patients with resectable disease, whether we should give them chemotherapy first. And if there is enough evidence over the next few years suggesting that's the right step for these patients, because as you probably know, pancreatic cancer is often considered as these patients are considered to have micrometastatic disease, and that's the reason why they get early recurrence so quickly within the first year. So neoadjuvant chemotherapy might end up being the standard practice over the next few years. And if that becomes standard practice, then we would not be doing any fast-track approvals because most patients would be subjected to chemotherapy first.
And if you do drain the biliary tree for these patients, what is the preferred route and what is the preferred type of stent?
If you do drain, the preferred route would be an ERCP because then you can avoid any external drains. The thing to remember is with an ERCP, there is a small risk of developing pancreatitis. And that's another reason why people are more keen on doing fast-track Whipples to avoid the risk of developing pancreatitis with an ERCP. So ERCP would be an option, would be the next step if someone's got obstructive jaundice. In terms of the stents, it depends what you're planning to do. If you're planning to undertake a resection straight away, and if they've got resectable disease, plastic stents are the way forward because they are cheap, and you're doing an operation within 3 to 4 weeks, so the risk of them falling out is low. But on the other hand, if someone's got a borderline resectable or local advanced tumor, you're contemplating chemotherapy first, then for these patients, it would be more reasonable to put a metal stent in because they need a durable stent which is going to last through their chemotherapy.
And are these covered stents or just a standard sort of old-fashioned metal stent that you'd use?
These are covered stents, so you should be able to remove them if you have to and then replace them because there is a small group of patients who might have blocked stents during their chemotherapy and might need stents replaced.
Okay. So if we now move to the exciting surgical aspect of pancreatic adenocarcinoma, the Whipples procedure, I know a lot of FRCS candidates have been asked about the technical side of things. So could you tell us a bit more about what a pancreatic duodenectomy involves, Sanjay?
Yeah, it's interesting. The first description was by Koch in 1912 of a pancreatic duodenectomy, which was then popularized by Whipples in 1935, an American surgeon. Over the last 100 years, essentially the steps have not really changed that much. Surprisingly, you know, unlike other surgical specialties where they have made, I'm sure, a lot of progress in terms of technical refinement, although we've managed to reduce the morbidity and mortality post-Whipple quite substantially over the last 10, 15 years, the actual technique has not significantly changed, apart from one or two areas in terms of whether we do a classic Whipple or a pylorus-preserving Whipple. Classic Whipple obviously is where you take the antrum of the stomach away with the resection specimen. On the other hand, with the pylorus preserving, you preserve the antrum and the pylorus of the stomach. The earliest evidence suggested that by preserving the pylorus, you might reduce the risk of delayed gastric emptying slightly. But randomized control trials did not really show much of a difference between a classic Whipple or a pylorus Whipple. It all depends on your comfort and what you've been trained to do. So it doesn't matter whether you do a classic Whipple or a pylorus Whipple. I tend to do the classic Whipple. I know, but some of my colleagues at the Freeman tend to do the pylorus preserving Whipples.
And is there any difference in terms of biliary reflux, for example, or dumping syndrome between the two techniques?
Not from the randomized controlled trials. Mm-hmm. It all comes down to your experience and training and what you're comfortable doing with. But apart from the reconstruction of the stomach, the rest of the procedure in terms of the bile duct resection, the duodenal resection, the proximal jejunal resection, the lymph node dissection is exactly the same between the classic Whipple and the pylorus preserving. The other area of quite a bit of controversy is, as you probably know, the common complications once you get when you do a Whipple operation is a gastrojejunostomy leak. The risk of that is less than 5%. A bile leak, again, less than 5%. But the most common leak we tend to encounter, which we dread as surgeons, is the pancreatic fistula, the postoperative pancreatic fistula rate, which are quite variable depending on what you read The rate of pancreatic fistula could be somewhere between 10 to 30%. And there are a lot of variables which will determine whether or not a pancreas would leak. A soft pancreas, a small duct is at much higher risk. On the other hand, a firm pancreas with a dilated duct is at a lower risk. So the risk of pancreatic fistula is determined case by case rather than a percentage overall. And that's to remember. And there are several ways of reconstructing the pancreatic remnant into the bowel. You could do a pancreatic jejunostomy, a pancreatic gastrostomy. Again, published data did not see any difference between pancreatic gastrostomy or jejunostomy in terms of pancreatic fistulas. Even within pancreatic jejunostomy, there are several ways of doing it. A Bloomgard technique or a standard pancreatico ductal mucosa anastomosis. Again, there is no evidence to say one technique is better than the other. We recently undertook a trial in the UK, the Penasta trial, which did not show any evidence, difference between the standard Bloomgard technique versus a pancreatico jejunostomy with a ductal mucosa technique. So again, it comes down to your training, your experience, and it's always better to stick to one technique and do the same technique again and again until you're comfortable with that technique. Eventually, when you start off as a junior consultant, your leak rates might be slightly higher than your senior colleagues, but as you gain experience and do the same technique and again, like anything else in surgery, you tend to get better and your leak rates do get lower over a period of time.
So for the non-hepatobiliary trainee, is it fair to say that the procedure is basically two stages? First stage is where you dissect and do a resection. And then the next stage is where you do the reconstruction, which are the methods that you talked about earlier. Is there anything that you would want to discuss in terms of the dissection side of things that a general surgeon needs to know about?
Yeah, as you probably said, you can start off from the incision. Some surgeons tend to do a midline incision and some surgeons tend to do a rooftop incision. Evidence again suggests there's no difference between what type of incision you use in terms of laparotomy. And once you get into the abdomen, it's generally a good idea to make sure there's no peritoneal disease or low volume liver metastasis. If there is, you should send some frozen sections. And the first step generally after that tends to be extended cauterization, where we mobilize the duodenum so that the anterior surface of the IVC and aorta are fully exposed. Because if you see any lymphadenopathy in that area, in the parietic lymph nodes, if they're enlarged, again, that's considered as M1 disease. There's no evidence to support extended lymphadenectomy at this stage. So if you see any lymph nodes in the aortic cable window or the parietic region, again, you should send frozen sections. And if those are positive, then we shouldn't really proceed with the resection. So that's the first step. And once you've undertaken the cauterization, then we tend to open the lesser sac so that we can expose the neck of the pancreas to identify the SMV. Once we see the SMV, that's the area generally where you tend to be a little bit careful, because the middle colic vein comes and joins the SMV and there is a small risk of bleeding if you're not very careful. And once you get bleeding, it can be a bit tricky to control the bleeding in that area. So that's one area of the operation where you really need to slow down until you can get a tunnel under the neck of the pancreas. And once you get a tunnel under the neck of the pancreas and the SMV is separated from the back of the pancreas, then you can do the portal dissection and identify the gastroduodenal artery, divide the gastroduodenal artery, divide the common bile duct, and then you can complete the tunnel in the neck of the pancreas. And then you can divide the neck of the pancreas. Once the pancreatic neck is divided, then you can divide the DJ flexure, transect the jejunum around the DJ flexure, and separate the head of the pancreas from the SME and SMA. Essentially, these are the steps.
That's the resection side of things.
That's the resection side. Mm. And there is a lot of interest recently whether we should do artery first approach, where the dissection should be on the adventitia of the SMA, to see if we can clear all the nerve plexuses and try and get an R0 resection. There's only one trial which did not show any difference between a standard approach but an artery first approach. But by doing an artery first approach, the evidence suggests the risk of bleeding is less and the perioperative outcomes are slightly better compared to a standard approach. But it takes a lot of time and some experience to do the artery first approach.
Okay. So is there room for minimally invasive Whipple's procedure?
There is increasing interest, and there's a lot of centers in America and some centers in Europe which are proponents of a minimally invasive pancreatic duodenectomy. The Freeman, we have done a few cases. But there's no good evidence from randomized controlled trials here. There is only two trials published which they say it is feasible. A minimally invasive pancreatic duodenectomy is feasible with relatively low morbidity and mortality. But you have to remember the learning curve is quite long. To become proficient in a laparoscopic pancreatic duodenectomy, it could be up to 100 to 200 cases. Although with the advent of the robot, the learning curve could be much shorter. But again, it comes down to the numbers. You know, for a surgeon to do 50 pancreatic duodenectomies with a robot to become proficient, it might take 2 to 3 years to do that. But it does have effect on training juniors and so on and so forth. So at this point of time, the standard practice in the UK and elsewhere is still an open pancreatic duodenectomy. And most of the minimal invasive pancreatic duodenectomies, if they're undertaken, are undertaken as part of a trial.
And it's worth noting at this point that the procedure that you choose depends on the location of the tumour. And that goes without saying. So a Whipple's procedure would only be undertaken if you've got a head of the pancreas adenocarcinoma. But if you had a lesion in the body or the tail, what would you consider there?
So if there is a tumour in the body or tail of the pancreas, then we do a distal pancreatectomy where you leave the head of the pancreas behind. And you can either preserve the spleen or take the spleen out with the specimen. It depends on the indication why you're doing a distal pancreatectomy. If you're doing a distal pancreatectomy for cancer, we tend to do a splenectomy as well, because often the metastasis, if there is in the lymph nodes, it tends to be in the splenic hilum as well, into the splenic lymph nodes. So you have to do a splenectomy as part of the distal pancreatectomy. On the other hand, if you're doing a distal pancreatectomy for instance, a side branch IPMN, so you may want to preserve the spleen. So it depends on the indication, but often a distal pancreatectomy would involve a splenectomy as well. And most of these cases are done laparoscopically. There's more evidence for a laparoscopic distal pancreatectomy than a pancreatic duodenectomy. The evidence suggests for distal pancreatectomy using a laparoscopic technique, the quality of life is much better. The hospital stay is much shorter than an open distal pancreatectomy. We still do not know if laparoscopic or open is better for patients with pancreatic cancer undergoing distal pancreatectomy, and there's currently a trial underway, the Diploma trial, which might give us the answer to see if open or laparoscopic is better for patients with pancreatic cancer having distal pancreatectomy.
Sanjay, thank you very much for that. That's been very informative. I've actually learned quite a lot from that today, and I'm sure many of the listeners have too.
Thank you, Eamon, and thank you for asking me to come and talk about this very important topic.
Join us again for another episode of Scrubcast, where we'll be talking about acute pancreatitis, another important FRCS topic. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye. I think we're done.
Did you go all right?
It was good.
I don't think so.
All right, sorry.